Welcome to MBA Podcaster, the only broadcast source for cutting-edge information and advice on the MBA application process. I'm Janet Nakano. Whether you're just thinking about business school or have already started the process, this time we're covering everything from applying to graduating. You'll learn about researching and choosing schools, writing the essays, taking the GMAT, and calculating your return on investment. We'll even give you tips on nailing the interview, deciding between schools, and launching your post-MBA career. You'll hear from an admissions director, a consultant, the CEO of an MBA touring organization, and the senior editor of Forbes. Before embarking on the lengthy MBA application process, it's a good idea to calculate what your return on investment would be. Forbes.com ranks business schools on the ROI. Senior editor Kurt Bodenhausen.
What we look at is the cost of getting your MBA, and that basically comes down to 2 years of foregone salary as well as 2 years of tuition. And then we look at what your actual earnings are once you get out of school. So we ask alumni what they were making the year they got out of school, what they were making 3 years out of school, and then finally what they're making 5 years out of school. So we get a pretty good idea of their 5 years of earnings right out of school. And then what we do is look at their pre-NBA salaries, and we extrapolate what they would have earned over time had they not gone to business school. And the difference between those numbers, and once you take out the cost in terms of tuition and foregone salary, leaves you with what we call your five-year MBA gain. And for top-ranked Dartmouth last year, that was $134,000. So in theory, the typical Dartmouth grad who graduated in 2000 would have had $134,000 more than had they not gone to school.
Forbes has an ROI calculator on their website that comes in handy if you want to figure out your own MBA gain.
What we do is we allow people to enter their current salaries, give them an idea of what tuition is, in-state or out-of-state, and then look at the salary gains that you might expect from that school by looking at the average salary for recent graduates. And then what we do is show you what the average gain was as well for those graduates over the course of 5 years for the different schools. So, you know, the typical Harvard grad might see 12% increases in their salary their first 5 years out of school, while maybe someone at a state school might be 6 or 7% gains after coming out of school.
Forbes ROI calculator doesn't include every MBA program. If your school isn't listed, Bodenhausen says you can easily get tuition and average salary info from a school's website or simply by calling the school. Now, choosing the MBA programs you want to apply will require a bit of research. Michael Cohen is president of MBA Prep Advantage. He says the schools you choose should fit into three groups.
We recommend for students to apply to a combination of reach, target, and safety schools. So the first task is determining which schools you wish to attend and then placing each school in one of these categories. The key things to consider for determining which schools to attend are things like reputation, specialization of the school, size, location, pedagogy in terms of whether it's instruction is case study or lecture or combination or experiential, the environment. Certain schools are more conducive for families, like let's say Tuck, when then you have other schools right in the middle of a city like Columbia. Alumni strength, especially in specific regions of the world. Certain schools have more influence in certain areas than others. And then career placement. Okay, so now you have your list of schools. You must then determine which are reach, target, and safety schools for you. And so this is kind of getting an honest assessment on what is realistic as opposed to merely what you desire. And as a very rough guide, you can determine whether your GPA and GMAT are below, at, or above the school's averages. However, your GPA can then be adjusted up or down depending on the strength of your undergraduate institution and also major. For example, engineering degrees are usually bumped up a little bit because those classes are graded in a more difficult manner, and also they tend to be harder. Although your statistics are only part of the story, you have to also have an understanding of, compared with your peer group, how accomplished are you within your professional, personal, and community dimensions. At this point, admission consultants or other people who are at the schools might be useful for giving you accurate feedback as to your chances and help you kind of place them in one of these buckets.
Julie Barefoot is MBA admissions director at Goswetta Business School at Emory University. She says here are a couple reasons why individuals choose this school.
Number one has to do with our small size and the fact that they can get a very personalized education here. We have a very flexible curriculum, and they really feel like they can personalize their academic goals and curriculum through our program. Secondly is our leadership. We have a very strong leadership program. It's very experiential. There are over 300 leadership opportunities that students take advantage of. Again, it goes back to our small size. We only enroll in our full-time program about 150 people every fall, and about almost 60 in our one-year program. And so it means that opportunities for one-on-one relationships with faculty and fellow students, as well as the fact they can participate in this, in the leadership program.
Barefoot says many Goswetta alumni go into three main sectors.
We're very well known in the area of marketing, and so we usually about a 25% or a third of our students go into marketing, like brand management or in market research. About a third typically go into finance, and that would be in corporate finance or investment banking primarily. And then consulting is the third most popular area, and we place a number of students at the top-tier consulting firms. We also, though, have other areas that students are interested in. Those are the three most popular areas, but we also have a number of students every year that go into real estate, the nonprofit sector, and also sports and media and entertainment. That's a growing area. It's still a fairly small number of students that are interested in it, but as you can imagine, they're passionate about it. And Atlanta is a great city for that because we have CNN here, you know, Turner, Cox Communications is a major communications firm. So there are a lot of opportunities, you know, just right here in town in Atlanta, you know, for summer internships and things like that.
This is MBA Podcaster. Stay tuned to the rest of the program after a brief word from our sponsor.
Support for MBA Podcaster comes from Manhattan GMAT, the world's largest GMAT-exclusive test preparation provider. Developed by Ivy League education professionals and continually updated to reflect current trends, Manhattan GMAT's advanced curriculum goes beyond teaching the tricks and focuses on in-depth content understanding as well. All programs are taught by highly trained and experienced instructors with GMAT scores of 750 or better. Visit ManhattanGMAT.com/MBA Podcaster to explore program options including a two-week intensive boot camp, private tutoring, and 9 session courses offered in a classroom setting or online through a live interactive platform. MBA Podcaster listeners will receive a $100 discount on Manhattan GMAT programs by using the code PODCAST2006 when enrolling for courses. Visit ManhattanGMAT.com/MBA Podcaster to enroll and receive your discount. Manhattan GMAT, the new standard in GMAT preparation.
Stay tuned at the end of this show to learn more about Manhattan GMAT. Hear how this test prep provider can help you outperform on the GMAT exam. You'll also hear their top 10 study tips and test-taking strategies. One good way to get to know the different schools is by attending an MBA event like the MBA Tour, CEO Peter von Lessica.
Our events offer them the opportunity to meet directly with the school, make themselves known, their career aspirations known, and when it comes time to apply, once they've met an admissions representative at one of our events, they've actually got a face to a piece of paper even before they appear on campus. There's quite a bit known about that candidate, which helps in the admissions process, certainly if they're academically qualified.
The MBA Tour will be holding its national fairs in New York, Boston, Chicago, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. Its international fairs will begin next fall in Asia, Latin America, Canada, and Europe. Von Lessica says at these events, since you'll have a chance to meet the admissions representatives, it's a good idea to come prepared.
It's always good to put a little bit more on the table than what's recorded in our pre-registration, which is more of a verbal description of of what your career aspirations are, what you're looking for, and certainly demonstrate that you've researched the school, because oftentimes admissions representatives are faced or asked to answer questions that are very basic with information that's easily found on the internet. And it's when you show some insight into the school or challenge them in a way that they have to think about answering the question for what your interests are, that they really take note of the candidate who they're talking to. And especially if it's in a program, a particular program that that school is offering and wants to showcase to the market.
Is this a good time for a candidate to ask about their own application? I mean, what is a good use of their time?
Generally, our events are early enough in the cycle where many of the candidates have not submitted their application. Unless they've requested time to meet with the individual school representative when they're traveling through the city, it is not the time to ask about an individual application during the event. But we are in these cities long enough, and many of the representatives stay an extra day, especially in the States, to interview you. It is, you know, that candidates would be well advised to ask if they could interview with the admissions representative while they're in town.
Some recommend applying to as few as 3 schools. Some say apply to 8 or 9 to maximize your chances. Michael Cohen says 5's a good number, but how many schools you should apply depends on how much time you have and how similar the essay questions are.
Generally, we recommend applying to at least 1 safety school and 1 reach school. However, schools like Cornell and Yale have incredibly easy applications that clients can do quickly, and so there wouldn't be much extra cost in terms of time for them to get that accomplished. On the other hand, schools like Stanford and Sloan have fairly unique applications, and to add to those would be a significant time investment.
The essays are the most critical part of the application, says Michael Cohen. He says, start as early as possible and think deeply about who you are professionally, personally, and in the community.
For example, within the professional dimension, understand how your responsibilities, competencies, and skills have increased over time, especially the leadership, managerial, and teamwork abilities. And then drill down so you can identify how you lead, what strategies you employ, and then also understand which achievements within the professional realm are more important and why. So, for example, if you're somebody with a technical background, analyzing a key technical area or building an important interface by yourself would probably be less important than initiating some form of best practice within your department, influencing various stakeholders to adopt that best practice, and then working with a variety of teams to train them and spread the best practice across the department, because that would involve a bunch of skill sets that are relevant or more relevant for a business school. Now, within the personal area, identify your passions, your pursuits, and hobbies outside of work that define who you are and reveal important characteristics about you. Then see if you can map these activities within your target schools. Admission committees want to admit human beings with character, and the personal aspect allows you to tell your story. Usually in at least 1 essay, you will write about non-professional activities, and more often than not, more than 1 essay. Now, for the community dimension, what is your record of organizational accomplishment and leadership development outside the office? What is the passion that defines you as a human being, and how is that shown through your activities? And again, can you map these to similar activities within your target schools?
Cohen says, remember that you'll be writing in business English. That means you won't be building up to a story. He says instead, you should answer the question as quickly as possible, then give reasons to support your answer. Gosueta's Julie Barefoot says the best essays are the ones that demonstrate how a student will contribute to a class.
We care a lot about the essay that has to deal with an accomplishment, and we really like to see their work accomplishment, ideally one where the applicant has had a business problem to tackle, you know, a challenge, and they've really worked with others. You know, we have a very team focus in our program, and of course the business world is very team-oriented, as everyone knows. And so it's really helpful if we can see in that essay where the applicant has been able to work with others to solve a problem. And in many instances, they may not be managing that person, but they're really having to develop, you know, to use their interpersonal skills and goals and plans to really to accomplish an objective and to add value to an organization, to solve a problem or to enhance revenues or whatever the case may be.
If you haven't already looked into the GMAT, start by taking a diagnostic test to see where you stand. If you think you need a test prep course, Michael Cohen says here are some reasons why it could be a good idea.
The advantages of working with a test preparation company are their structured approach. You'll have classes occurring at certain points, and you'll have homework and so forth, and a lot of people need that structure. Also, obviously, subject matter expertise. You're making the assumption that the test preparation you're going with has a certain level of expertise within the GMAT. Additionally, access to written material and diagnostic tests. You know, they'll have a whole bunch of more diagnostic tests, and with the GMAT, you have to practice. Now, you can take classes or you can do private tutoring. Private tutoring costs more than classes, but there's advantage in terms of personalized attention and scheduling flexibility. If you're somebody who has difficulty in a specific area, like sentence corrections, or you have certain types of problems that you have difficulty with, let's say questions that you have to use data sufficiency methods or percentages or things like that, tutoring might be the better approach because you can drill down and be more specific with your studying.
MBA interviews won't be all too stressful if you come prepared. Cohen says here are some tips on nailing the interview.
Prepare main points you wish to discuss and introduce these points within more open questions that the admission committee might ask. So a lot of times you'll get open questions like, walk me through your resume, and if you understand the takeaways from each job or from your educational experience before hearing that question, you'll be able to answer it more effectively. Prepare answers to generic questions like, what are your goals? Discuss a time that you've led a team, etc. There are certain questions that you should be expecting, and you should have in your mind roughly a 2-minute answer for those questions and then be prepared to drill down. Another tip would be precise in your wording. Do not merely say, I'm a great leader, or I have great leadership skills. Understand why you're a great leader. Do you have an ability to visualize an end? Are you excellent at motivating others? Do you have the interpersonal skills to build consensus? Are you the type of person that provides support for people, whether it's emotionally or in terms of tasks or something like that, and that's your leadership style? A variety of people have a variety of effective ways to lead, and you should be able to identify what your leadership style is and give examples of that leadership style in action. Another tip would be to research the schools so you can specifically talk about activities beyond the obvious. Also, a lot of the questions that you're going to ask at the end, some of them will be related to the area that you're wishing to pursue upon graduation. So you should have an understanding if the school conducts conferences in these areas especially if the school is a thought leader in that area. In terms of your voice, when you're answering the questions, try not to use verbal utterances like etc. People state verbal utterances when their mind is not thinking as quickly as their mouth is speaking. And so you end up having to say, so that your mind can catch up. And you can always pause. And finally, keep the focus on you, not your group. I mean, I understand that schools value teamwork, but they are admitting you. So if you were instrumental in a team accomplishing a goal, discuss how you were influential in helping the team to then achieve that goal rather than merely talking about the team and achieving that goal.
Admissions Director Julie Barefoot says most candidates do well in the interview, but she says she does see a couple common mistakes.
Number one is they don't address the question fully enough, or the other side of that same coin is they address it too fully and are too, they're not succinct. And I realize that that's kind of both ends of the spectrum, but it's important that when a candidate goes into an interview with Gesueta, or, you know, it's not unlike a job interview. It's not as stressful as a job interview. We really do try to make it a conversation. We do not ask any trick questions. We're only just going to ask questions about things on the resume, about your personal experiences. We're not going to be testing anything about a candidate's quantitative skills. So, again, it shouldn't be a stressful experience. But some candidates, if we ask them a question, they're very brief. They might only give a one-sentence answer that doesn't really show much insight or really thought or give context to their experiences. That's a concern. And then conversely, is a candidate that goes, that we ask one question, for example, walk me through your resume quickly, and they might take 15 minutes. And, you know, this is a problem because the interview only lasts about 30 or 40 minutes, and then we don't have time to ask them other questions. Those two sort of issues are probably the most common. Less common, but frankly quite damaging, is when a candidate doesn't have good eye contact, basically is unusually nervous. You know, again, we want candidates, you know, hopefully they're going to apply. They have confidence in themselves. We don't want them to be overly confident, but, you know, they have confidence in themselves and their work experience, and we really want it. We want them to feel good about chatting with us.
It might be considered a fortunate dilemma to choose between two or more schools you've been accepted to. If you're caught in this position, Cohen suggests another round of research.
Once you're accepted, the schools usually have an admit weekend, which I definitely recommend attending. During that admit weekend, you'll hear speeches from a variety of the faculty and some of the administration and professors, and you'll meet other students. You will participate in some of the activities there. You'll meet future classmates who are in the same position that you are, and you'll get a real feeling of the environment of the school. And so I think that's pretty important. Additionally, you can contact student members of clubs that are within your career areas. Ideally, you would have done this at the beginning when you're researching the schools, but you can start reaching out to members of the community to start asking the more difficult questions. When you're an applicant, you might not have wanted to push people to the point of saying, all right, so exactly how successful were candidates with my profile obtaining these types of positions? But when you're admitted, you can be a little bit more pointed with your due diligence. Once you've accepted an offer from school, after you've gone through this extra due diligence phase, congratulations, you know. After all the time and effort that you've spent in terms of preparing your applications, in terms of attending these admit weekends and finally accepting, you know, you deserve to treat yourself to something, whatever that is and whatever it is you enjoy. At that point, you're going to start getting material from the school that's going to tell you about summer trips to various parts of the world so you can bond with your classmates. There might be local mixers within your city. You might have access to an online forum. There might be math refresher courses that you can take prior to the beginning of your class. And some people even consider quitting their job earlier and traveling and doing things that they would not have an opportunity to do again because we're not given an extended break from our professional career that often.
Once on campus, things will move quickly, says Cohen. In as little as 3 months, you'll be meeting with recruiters and searching for that next career opportunity.
Hopefully, you have a really good understanding of what it is that you want to do and the resources the school has to help you accomplish that so that once you're there, you can start leveraging and utilizing these resources. For certain traditional types of jobs, like strategic consulting or investment banking, there's a fairly structured process. Career Services has companies come on for on-campus recruiting. You have clubs that support your ability to perform well in the case interviews. The schools themselves come onto campus for company-sponsored career nights that give you an opportunity to network. And additionally, you can then start identifying those companies to which you'd like to work for but don't come on campus for recruiting, and you could start sending cover letters, and they'll have a structured process also. Now, for non-standard jobs, hopefully you're applying to the school that has a strength in your area so that they also have a structured process for helping you obtain employment. You know, MIT has expertise in operations, Kellogg in marketing, Yale in nonprofits, Duke in healthcare, et cetera. And for those schools, they will have the same type of programs to help you obtain employment as the strategic consulting and investment banking jobs. Now, assuming that you're at a school who does not have a strength in that area, now that's when you're going to have to get some elbow grease, and that's when you're going to have to work very hard to make the contacts within the companies that will help you gain employment and start doing a campaign outside of the career services. You would start with the career services. The career services are going to have assorted programs like mock interviews, company profiles, everything else. So you'll begin the process of looking for jobs by visiting the Career Services Center.
Stay tuned to learn more about Manhattan GMAT. Hear how this test prep provider can help you outperform on the GMAT exam. I'm Janet Nakano with MBA Podcaster. Remember your favorite teacher? Remember being excited to go to class? Well, that's exactly the kind of test prep experience Manhattan GMAT strives to provide. They believe that if you have an excellent teacher, you'll focus, absorb the material quickly, and get your best possible score. This time, we're going to check out Manhattan GMAT at their New York offices. We'll learn about the company, its teachers, and visit a class, hear from a current student and alumni. You'll also get Manhattan GMAT's top 10 tips on studying for and taking the exam.
You've just accepted your fate. I have to take the GMAT, you admit to yourself.
Manhattan GMAT's Chris Ryan.
And now, you admit one more thing. No, I can't walk in and take it cold. So you're contemplating all the research you have to do. Tomorrow, you'll start trolling the online forums, talking to friends about their GMAT prep experiences, and even haunting the study aids aisle of your local Barnes & Noble. But right now, you don't want to buy anything exactly. You want general principles. Whichever books you pick up, whatever course you take, how should you think about preparing for the GMAT? Here are five tips to guide you. Tip number one. Go to the source. Many religions have holy books, right? Well, the official guides from the GMAC in their orange, purple, and green splendor are the holy books of the GMAT religion. Every other book, as good as it may be, is just commentary. Only the official guides contain problems retired from the real GMAT. Thus, your efforts must be centered on the official guides. The other quote-unquote holy source is GMAT Prep, the free practice test software that you should download from MBA.com. This software has its drawbacks, but it also has two unique benefits. It uses the real GMAT algorithm for one thing, and even more importantly, it contains retired GMAT problems, many of which aren't in the official guides. There are two tests offered on this software. You should consider saving at least one of them for later in your preparation to use as a measuring stick. Though the GMAC sources are the best, don't ignore third-party resources. Not surprisingly, I believe that the Manhattan GMAT resources are great. For instance, our computer adaptive exams supply crucial explanations and analytics that GMAT Prep lacks. Our strategy guides break down the core principles and give you lots of relevant practice. Tip number two, build up, not down. We see it all the time. Whole herds of students go running off to find super hard problems. If I can crack these, the herds think, I can do any GMAT problem. Don't follow the herds. How you do on the GMAT is determined by your floor, the level of problem that you can absolutely positively get right every time without hesitation or anxiety. So you should spend more time truly mastering the easier problems. And by mastering, I mean ensuring that you can do the problem not only correctly, but also quickly, easily, and confidently under tough exam conditions, as if Dirty Harry himself were leveling his .44 Magnum at you and asking if you feel lucky. By mastering, I mean knowing everything there is to know about the problem, the underlying principles, the subtle application of those principles, the embedded tricks and traps. I mean knowing how to teach the problem, knowing how to write a similar problem. Once you have built this knowledge and skill, then progress upwards. It's like building a brick wall. Don't put the next layer on until the current layer is in place. Of course, for top scorers, you'll need to practice against some really tough problems, but make sure all the lower levels are solid first. Tip number 3, turn enemies into friends. Should you play to your strengths or attack your weaknesses? Well, ideally, you'll do both, but if you have to choose, especially early on, pick the weaknesses. Let's say you're a genius on critical reasoning, but you're terrible at sentence correction. Which should you work on? Well, the sentence correction. Why? Because the test is adaptive. If sentence correction is weighing your performance down, you'll never get the really hard critical reasoning problems. So face your demons. Eat your vegetables. Do you hate geometry? Then do those problems first. Consider them the enemy plans that have fallen into your hands and extract all the intelligence. Then, as you master individual enemy problems, turn them into your friends. Become totally comfortable with them. Then, when you walk into the GMAT, none of the questions will throw you completely off your game plan. Tip number 4, mix it up. You know you should do a lot of topic-based work, especially in your weak areas. And you know you'll have to take practice tests to prepare for the GMAT's adaptive format, which is both less familiar and more stressful than a paper-based format. That's all well and good. But don't limit yourself to topic-based work and practice tests. Topic-based drills are indispensable, but they give you a crutch. You already know what kind of problem you're facing. In contrast, the GMAT throws you problems in random order by content area. So you need to develop your eye, your ability to recognize patterns, perceive key traits, classify problems, and bring relevant strategies to bear. In this regard, practice tests would seem to help you here, and they do. But you can't, or you shouldn't, take a practice test every day. You can burn yourself out all too easily. After every practice exam, you need time to study the detailed game film, to draw out lessons and to fix the issues. That's several days of work before you take another practice exam. So what should you do when you're not taking practice exams? Short drills of mixed topic problems from the official guides. The GMAC has already done the prep work for you. They've jumbled up the problems by topic but arranged them in order of difficulty. So do 5 to 10 problems in a row. Don't skip any. And then spend double the time afterwards reviewing and mastering each problem. You can do this kind of drill every day, especially as you get closer to the real exam, and your GMAT muscles will grow strong. Tip number 5, know what you know. It's 2 weeks to the exam. You've done a ton of work and your head is kind of swimming. Stop making your head swim. Start reviewing and redoing problems. At this point, it's much less important to cram new stuff into your brain than it is to organize and strengthen what's already in there. Don't worry about trying to cover everything under the sun. Instead, go for depth over breadth. Force yourself to revisit problems you think you know. You'll be surprised at what you don't really know. Master a few representative problems from each topic tested on the GMAT. Know everything about these problems. For each one, have a crystal clear approach plan, and also a plan B, C, and even D, that you can execute correctly, quickly, easily, and confidently, while taking enemy fire, so to speak. Now work those problems again until you've licked them. You want to walk into the exam with a bunch of friends, that is, official guide problems that you know cold, inside and out. Oh yeah, you should take 1 or 2 more practice exams in the last couple of weeks, but don't overdo it. With all these principles in hand, you'll be well-equipped to study for the GMAT in order to put your best foot forward on test day. But bear in mind that nothing will replace good old-fashioned elbow grease. Statistics from the GMAC show that the amount of time spent studying, both in terms of hours and weeks, correlates positively to performance on the test. 100 plus hours and 8 plus weeks are the best average results, if you're curious. Let's call this tip number 6. There aren't really any shortcuts to success on the GMAT.
Stay tuned for Manhattan GMAT's top 5 GMAT test-taking strategies later on in the program. It was Zeke Vanderhook who founded Manhattan GMAT. He was a former middle school teacher in Harlem for Teach for America. CEO Andrew Yang says Zeke based the company on one core principle.
Zeke very much believed, we think very correctly, that the teacher is the primary component of any educational experience. That if you have an outstanding teacher, you'll have an outstanding experience. And if your teacher is not that good, then no matter what other pieces are in place, your experience probably won't be outstanding. And that's really the main founding principle of Manhattan GMAT, that we try and find the best teachers and pay them accordingly and even try and develop them further to be the best they can be. So to represent that we're interested in hiring the best teachers, we pay a $1,000 signing bonus for all new instructors, plus $100 an hour to start, plus annual bonuses. We think that this compensation package is easily the highest in the industry, which represents how serious we are about finding the best teachers. We're so serious that we'll even pay anyone who refers to us, someone who becomes an instructor, $1,000 as well. So if you know any smart people out there and you think they might want to teach the GMAT, you can feel free to send them our way, and we'll pay you $1,000 just for sending them to us. Though you should be warned that in order to become an instructor with us, the individual would need to have a 99th percentile score and past teaching experience, and even then, the chance of them getting an offer is about 1 in 5 historically.
The whole company is really energetic and young and collaborative. It's awesome.
That's Carol Chang, one of Manhattan GMAT's instructors.
I'm not saying that because they told me to say it. It really is. And
Carol says what she enjoys most about teaching is creating classroom spirit.
Like, we're all working together against this mean test because it's just out to get us. And so all we have to do is work together and strategize and see the different tricks. And when you do that, you really build this collegial spirit in the classroom. And then people don't treat it like this big bore, because that's what this test can be. It can be stifling and boring and overwhelming. And it's really intimidating because you can be great at math and then all of a sudden you pop out your first test with a dismal percentile and you can get really discouraged. But all you have to do is teach people and have them work together and see how you could just see around the GMAT's tricks and traps. And when you do that all together in the classroom, it's really fun. And that's definitely my favorite part about teaching.
Enrolling for business school. So many of you are going to be shooting for fall of 09, I know, but that would be interesting.
It's Sunday evening, and Carol is teaching the first class of a 9-week course. Let's stay for a while and check it out.
Except for me. My name is Carol. Carol Chang, that's my name, that's my email. I went to Harvard, I studied sociology, loved it. After I graduated, I moved to the Chinese side of the Chinese-North Korean border. I am Korean, and there's a big Korean ethnic minority population there. So I was teaching and working over there. It was really interesting. And then about a year ago, I came back here to New York. First thing that we should go over is the GMAT test itself. So some of you have taken it, but the majority of people in here have never seen this test before. So how is it structured? There's 3 sections. Really, there's only 2 sections that you need to focus your energy on. It begins with 2 essays in 60 minutes. We'll talk about these essays briefly in session 6, but basically all you have to worry about is get through the essays, do a decent job, and just save all your energy for the real test, which is the quant and the verbal. So we have the quant and the verbal section. Each one is 75 minutes. Now, there's 37 questions in the quant section for 75 minutes. So about how much time is that per question? Just about 2 minutes, right? Because if it was 2 minutes, it would be 74 minutes, and you have a minute to spare for, like, the clicking, next confirm, and all that stuff. So that's what we're going to be doing in class. Whenever we pull up a math problem, I have this handy-dandy stopwatch here, and I'm going to be timing you. And I'm going to cut you off at 2 minutes and then ask you to hold up your answers. Okay. All of those 37 questions, about 15 of them are what we call data sufficiency, and 22 of them about are problem solving. So problem solving is your straight-up multiple choice, A, B, C, D, E, right? Pick the answer. Data sufficiency, for those of you who've taken the test before, is the bane of everybody's existence. Because data sufficiency asks you not to solve the problem, but to just say if you have enough information so that you could solve it. And that's really, really tricky. And there's all these nasty tricks and traps and language things that they throw in front of you. And so it's not really an issue of, you know, do you know the math? It's more, do you know what they're trying to ask you? All right, then you have the verbal session. And that's 75 minutes, but it has 41 questions instead of 37. So how much time is that per question? Less than two. That's a good answer. Right? It's about like a minute 40-ish if you were to divide it evenly, but we're not going to divide it evenly because these questions are not created equal. You have sentence correction, which is basically like a lot of grammar stuff you have to know. Then you have critical reasoning, which is like you get a paragraph, it's talking about an argument, and then you have to answer a question about that argument. Then you have reading comp, very straight up, have a passage, answer questions about that passage. Okay? Sentence correction is mostly about grammar. Because it's mostly about grammar, which has rules, we're going to whip you into army soldiers, and you're going to execute these in under 60 seconds. Okay? So the time for those ones is just 1 minute, and then for critical reasoning, we'll give you 2 minutes, and then timing for reading comp ends up being about 2 minutes. So we have a timing mechanism online, but really what I recommend is you just get a physical stopwatch. So you don't have to be online to do it. Any of you guys have the iPhone? The iPhone has a beautiful stopwatch on it. The key is that you have something that has a lap button over here, right? So the way that you use this, you can get it at like Modell's or Paragon Sports, you just press start, right? And let's say you're doing 5 problems in a set, right? So you click start. And then let's say the problem's like, what is 3 plus 2? You're like, 5, E, right? Then you pick your answer. Don't click stop, click lap, because you're done with the first problem. And then you're like, problem number 2, what is 3 plus 1? 4, great. And then you finish the second lap, you finish the third problem, finish the fourth problem. And then at the end of the set, you click stop. And then you click recall, and then you can see how long each lap or each problem took you. Okay? And timing is absolutely everything on this test. If you want to learn the content, then you have to know how to manage your time. If you guys do that, you'll be golden on this test. And you cannot do these problems untimed. Right? One of the biggest mistakes that people make when they're preparing for this test is to do things untimed. Right? It's like learning physics in a frictionless world. It doesn't matter. There's friction. It doesn't matter because the test is timed. You need to use this. Many of you are wondering when you're going to be ready to take the test. So this is the ideal timeline. If you put in 10 to 15 hours of homework a week, which is not that bad, it's 2 to 3 hours a day of studying, which is just 5 days a week. Then, after class is done, after these 9 weeks, count on 2 weeks of additional study, and then take your first exam. Right? About a month later, count on taking your second exam. An alternate timeline is this. You know, if you can only put in about half the homework, like 4 hours, count on 3 months of additional study. If you can only do like 8 hours, 1 month of additional study. Then, schedule your first exam. A month later, schedule your second exam, or count on taking your second one. This is where I get a lot of scowls in class. Everybody's like, why? Why do you want to take it twice? Don't you just want to take it once and do well? Why would we ever recommend to take it twice? Really counterintuitive. And I was like this too. I was like, I don't understand why. I mean, in life, don't you just want to prepare for something and prepare well and then take something and then do well? But a lot of people get nervous. You know, before the test, and you go in, you're like anxious, and you can't, you know, you have butterflies, and then something goes wrong, and you know, you just don't want to put like all your eggs in that one basket. And for a lot of people, if they're so anxious before they go in, then if you really just view this first test as your practice, this is just your first go, then a lot of times it eases anxiety and nerves about that first test, and then you can count on taking it a second time.
After an intense 3 hours, class ends, but not without knowing that the next 9 weeks will be challenging. But student Matt Ronan says, so far, so good.
I thought the teacher was very dynamic, very engaging, which made it worthwhile to be here, as opposed to taking it online, which is also an option. So it makes me glad that I took it for more money, but in person with the teacher.
Danielle DiCiaccio is Manhattan GMAT's Manager of Marketing and Student Services. She says the 9-week live course is the most popular.
The locations where we have the in-person classes are New York, Boston, Chicago, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, and some locations out on the West Coast in the San Francisco Bay Area, and also a number of spots in the Los Angeles region. And we'll also be in the Raleigh-Durham area and a couple other locations pretty soon as well. And the cost for the classes typically ranges between about $1,390 and $1,440, depending on the location. We also have the 9-week class offered in a virtual format.
Before we get started here, please know that participation is really an essential part of this online class. We can't see each other, obviously, but we can hear each other. And our feedback from students tell us that the class is definitely enriched when we have more perspectives than just the two instructors. So please feel free to ask questions over the microphone whenever you see fit, to ask questions through the direct messaging window whenever you think it's appropriate, give comments, give your own thoughts.
So that's great for students who either aren't located near one of our centers or are international students, or students who maybe could get to a center but prefer not to because of the convenience factor. And those classes meet once a week for 3-hour sessions for 9 weeks. We also have some self-study programs, which basically provide students with all of the materials, all of the resources that they'd get in a 9-week course, but it allows them to go through the material and the resources at their own pace. So if they want to go a little bit more quickly or a little bit more slowly, then they don't have maybe as big a need to have in-person instruction. And those packages are between $590 and $790. We also have a boot camp program that we hold a few times a year in New York City, which is $29.50 is the cost for that program. And that basically condenses the 9-week material into a very intensive 2-week program that meets pretty much every day for 2 weeks. And we also offer private tutoring, and that's available in person in all of our locations and also virtually. And that ranges somewhere between $215 to $245 an hour. And we also have workshops, which are one-day programs. They're held virtually for the most part. Our workshops typically are either on the fundamentals side or advanced workshops. So we have a couple foundations of math workshops that we do for people who are looking for just a review pretty much of the basics on the quantitative side. And then we also have some advanced workshops on both the quantitative and the verbal side.
Dean Kelly is a Manhattan GMAT alumnus. He lives in Canada, so he says he decided to take the virtual course.
It took some getting used to, I must say. It's something that, you know, I'm sure many people find strange in that you're sitting in front of your computer and literally having a live class. But after some time, I got used to it and it was like second nature.
Dean says he took courses with other test prep providers, but didn't get the results he was hoping for.
The GMAT is something that can trick your mind. And me having taken that test for 3 times over, I, you know, came under the realization that it can intimidate you. And if you're not properly prepared, you can easily get screwed over. But what Manhattan GMAT Prep does, it fine-tunes the procedure for you to actually conquer every aspect. And I'm not just saying this by, you know, trying to blow things out of proportion. I'm saying this because it actually worked for me. Like, for example, the general daily routines that I'm supposed to be following that they have on the online schedule, that, you know, in the way they have it structured, made me become more disciplined. And with the discipline came practice, and with the practice came a better understanding. And with that, that's one of the reasons why I'm so very successful.
Jeep Rochai Shanine Torn decided to take Manhattan GMAT's self-study program, which she says helped her get the score she wanted.
I took the first test, I got 650. Okay. And after I took a course with Manhattan GMAT, I got 700. You know, my weakness is English because I didn't grow up in the U.S., and I think that Manhattan GMAT really did a great job when I have very particular need. When I watch the classes, the recording video, I know that the class really emphasizes in math because that's where American students really want to focus on. So that's why I did a couple of hours of personal tutor, and I had a really good teacher. So he quickly drove to the direction that I want, which is critical reading, targeting my main weaknesses.
Manhattan GMAT provides scholarships through organizations like MBA Diversity and Beat the GMAT. And recently, the company created a new program called Social Venture Scholars. Again, Danielle DiCiaccio.
Through this program, we provide full tuition scholarships for students who work in the nonprofit world, and essentially people who are working towards positive social change. And because of that, because of the kind of work they do, they often aren't paid very handsomely for their work and can't really afford to put in so much money towards their preparation for school. Currently, we hold the courses in New York. We're hoping to soon expand that to virtual courses as well, so students in all different locations can participate. And the recipients of the scholarship have free tuition to one of our 9-week programs in our New York center and receive the tuition for the class and all of the materials free of cost. So it's designed for students who demonstrate a financial need and are working towards positive social change and want to use an MBA to further the work that they're doing towards positive social change.
Manhattan GMAT also organizes MBA admissions panel discussions to help you navigate through the application process. CEO Andrew Yang.
One of the benefits of our not offering admissions consulting services is that admissions officers from the top business schools are eager to work with us. They look askance a little bit at admissions consulting services, but GMAT prep is very much expected. So here in New York, we had an admissions panel with admissions officers from Harvard, Wharton, Columbia, and NYU last fall. We also had a panel in Chicago with Kellogg and the University of Chicago, where students can interact with admissions officers and get information directly from them. We think that this is a benefit that we can only offer, in part because we're something of the service provider to students who are shooting for these top schools. We're also the service provider to Goldman Sachs, McKinsey, Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan, Bank of America, and other schools that employ people that are shooting for top 10 programs, which is one reason why admissions officers from these schools are happy to work with us, because they can reach applicants that they're interested in through us.
Now, when it's finally time for you to take the GMAT, you'll want to go in with these 5 tips in mind. Again, Manhattan GMAT's Chris Ryan.
You've studied all the content. You've done hundreds of problems. You've taken practice test after practice test. And now, it's GMAT game day. You're following all the logistics tips. You got enough sleep last night. You've shown up early. You haven't eaten anything funny. And you plan to take the breaks while giving yourself enough time to check back in with the proctors. But what about actually taking the test? What do you have to remember while you're in the thick of battle? Tip number 1, turn the page. Imagine you've just clicked C, next, confirm, on a tough data sufficiency problem involving 2 overlapping triangles and lots of labeled angles. One of the statements was utterly baffling. You spent too much time deciding between C and E, and now you think you probably chose wrong with your luck. Forget all that. You are now facing a new problem. This is the only place your mind should be. Take out a blank sheet of mental paper and dive in. Now, as you get into this new problem, a whisper in your head tells you that the problem is too easy, so you probably did get the last problem wrong. And by the way, you're doing poorly overall. Turn that whisper off. You should not spend an instant of your time wondering about the past or about how you're doing. You truly have no idea how you're doing. And if you did know, it wouldn't help you anyway. The only opportunity you have to affect your fate is this problem. Forget about 1 minute ago. Focus on the here and now and do the problem as best you can. Tip number 2, know when to fold them. You are now embroiled in a different problem, and it's a dogfight. This problem seduced you. You thought you knew how to solve it, but the answer you got wasn't on the screen. Now you're scrambling to recheck all your math, and you can't find any errors. You're frustrated, and you feel like simply choosing the answer choice that's in the same ballpark as the answer that you calculated. Now take a deep breath. And remember that to win this war, you have to lose some battles. Don't be a perfectionist. Remember that even people who get very high scores on the GMAT get a substantial proportion of questions wrong. Be ready to cut bait and walk away. But, you think to yourself angrily, I've spent all this time and now it'll all be wasted. Well, maybe not. Step back and see if you can take an intelligent guess. Eliminate some answers if you can. Sometimes, actually, by giving up on Plan A, you can spot Plan B. which may not get you all the way to the right answer, but it might increase the odds. So now you give this plan B idea a try, and it doesn't work this time. You don't see any other way to attack this evil problem. What do you do now? Here's what you do. Tell yourself the problem is experimental, and that's why it's so cryptic. As many as a quarter of the questions are in fact experimental and will not count toward your score. Of course, you shouldn't try to guess which ones, but if you find yourself at approximately the 2-minute mark with no way forward on a particularly dastardly problem, tell yourself that the problem doesn't even count. Then take your shot and move on. Save your time to invest in problems you really know how to do. Tip number 3, do your work on the scratch paper, not in your head. Now you get a problem involving odds and evens. The problem looks pretty straightforward, so you start thinking, okay, let's see, x odd plus y even is odd, and then I multiply that odd by this other odd, and I get odd. Or I could have x be even, so then even plus even is even, and I multiply even by odd, and I get... Stop. You are setting yourself up for a fall. Your working memory can only hold a few items at a time under the best conditions. And studies have shown that under test pressure, the powers of your working memory shrink even further. Remember that other odds and evens problem you did in your head while you were sitting at your kitchen table with a plate of cookies? That problem won't be so easy right now here in the exam center. Write out your steps. Put the scenarios down on the scratch paper. Make the process as easy on your brain as possible. And be organized. Be a friend to your future self, the self you're going to be in 30 seconds when you're looking back over all these scribbles and trying to figure out what you just wrote down. Tip number 4, check the time periodically, but don't be clock paranoid. Now you're into another problem, and you're worried you're spending too much time. Your eyes dart to the clock every half a minute. You can just feel the seconds dropping away like grains of sand through the neck of an hourglass. There go a few more, and a few more. Stop. Focus on the problem you're doing. By checking the clock so often, you're taking your mind off of solving the problem itself. Moreover, you're liable to think you're taking more time than you actually are. As a result, you may put in too little effort and bail out too quickly. Manage time by keeping to a rhythm, a kind of internal drumbeat. Then, every so often, check the clock and figure out if you're ahead, behind, or right on pace. You can use benchmarks such as, where should you be every 15 minutes? Or you can simply compare the time left to the number of problems remaining. You should have 2 minutes per math problem and approximately 1 minute and 50 seconds per verbal problem overall, more for critical reasoning and reading comp, less for sentence correction. But don't compute the verbal side precisely. Simply figure out 2 minutes per problem, then take off about 10%. If you're behind, adjust your drumbeat accordingly. You'll need to shave seconds here and there. Don't try to make it all up in one fell swoop. Tip number 5, take a moment to smile. You've got 10 minutes left and 7 math problems to do. Panic has set in. You're about to start randomly guessing, even though you know how to do this problem in front of you. And you can't help thinking that the whole exam has gone horribly wrong. Okay, this last prescription will seem extremely difficult at first. Apply the muscles of your face to your tightly pursed lips, causing the corners to arch ever so slightly upwards as you breathe in deeply through your nose. Now let the breath back out. Keep smiling for a moment, even if it's forced. Emotion actually affects cognition for good or ill. If you panic, you can't think, and a direct way to change your emotional state is simply to fasten a brief smile on your face. Now get back into the fight, but stay positive. It's the best way to ensure that your performance measures up to your abilities. The GMAT is like a tennis match at Wimbledon. And just like a tennis pro, you should recognize that the game is not truly physical, it's mental. Control your mind on the court and your body will take care of itself. In a similar way, if you control your mind during the exam using the strategies described above, your hard-earned GMAT skills will show up and take care of business. Good luck.
For more information on Manhattan GMAT, visit manhattangmat.com. I'm Janet Nakano for MBA Podcaster. Thanks for listening.